This Dulectures episode features Chairman of the Hillsborough Family Support Group, Margaret Aspinall, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2019.
I've been here each day, unfortunately not each evening, I've been here each day and I've been made very, very welcome, my daughters and I, so I'd like to thank everybody concerned who's welcomed us to here today. But first and foremost, it's very difficult to see you, everybody, but first and foremost, can I just say to you, 30 years has took us to get where we are today. Some of you here might not even know what I'm talking about. Where are you today? Well, 30 years ago, 96 innocent people died going to watch a football game. And the challenges we had as families was the whole establishment was against us. Not just the establishment, but the media also. We had terrible press. And the reason we had that terrible press, because certain people who should have done their job did not do the job. And I'm talking about the safety issues of supporters going in to watch a football game. My son, James, he was just 18. He went to his first away game, which unfortunately happened to be at Sheffield Wednesday. And when he was going out the door, the last words James said to me was, "I won't be home till 7 o'clock this evening, Mum. But what time does our Kez come home?" You all might wonder who's Kez. Kez is James's sister, Kerry. And he was very, very close to Kerry and his younger siblings. He was the eldest of five children. But Kerry had been away to Cornwall with her Auntie Rose and Uncle John. And he hadn't seen her for a week. So he was really looking forward to Kerry coming home. I said, "She'll be home, James, around about 1 o'clock today." James's words to me were, "Please, Mum, don't put her to bed till I come home," because I was a very strict parent. I think two of my daughters are here now would be embarrassed about this. But I was a very strict parent. I liked them in bed at a certain time of an evening. I didn't allow them to play out in the street with other children because I just think you're annoying neighbours. So no, you play with each other. You've got a back garden, the same fresh air as in the back garden as what's in the front. So I was a very, very strict parent to them, but I brought them up to be respectful, as my mother brought all of us. I'm one of 10 children. I've got five brothers and four sisters. And my mother was very strict with us. She wouldn't allow us. We got raffle tickets from school. We could not go round neighbours and ask neighbours, would they buy a raffle ticket? Some people are poor. Don't be knocking on their doors. So that's the way I was brought up. And I brought my own family up the same way. But James was so looking forward to Kerry coming home. And he said, "Please, Mum, don't put her to bed till I come home." "Okay, go away, enjoy the game." Off he goes. Unfortunately, James came home to us 5 days later in a coffin. And as I say, he was my eldest child. This is just my story. The other families have their stories, who were just as devastated. But I didn't think anybody at that time could have loved their child like I loved mine. That was just the way I felt. And when I found out, 6 o'clock the following morning, my son died. I mean, you can imagine a whole night of not knowing, waiting for a phone call, going to police stations, phoning up the travel company, what James went by, and asking them about the passengers. I eventually got through to the travel company and they told me all the passengers are accountable for. But they had been impounded, the buses had been impounded until everything had cleared. So of course my poor husband was up and down to Sheffield looking for James. He wasn't on any of the list at the hospitals or even at the medical legal centre. He wasn't on any of the list. And when Jimmy eventually got through to me, now you can imagine a night. There was no mobile phones then. We had no mobile phones. All we had to depend on was telephone boxes or knocking on people's doors to use their telephone lines. So my husband started knocking on doors, and people were very kind up in Sheffield. They were letting people in to phone home up to let the families know they were safe. When my husband got through to me, after about 5 phone calls, I said to him, Jimmy, I've eventually got through to Barnes Travel and he's safe. They've told me all the passengers were accountable for, but the buses have been impounded. But he will be in Lime Street at midnight. So get home from Sheffield and we'll go meet him because I know he'll want a hug. More than anything, he'll want a hug from his mum. Absolutely, my husband was absolutely over the moon to know that James was safe. He comes all the way home from Sheffield. We all went down to Lime Street Station. Me, my husband, my son, James's friends all went down to Lime Street to watch all the coaches coming home. And we watched and waited for all the coaches to come in. And when the very last coach come in, I just run up to the driver. And I said, where's my son? Is it the driver knew my son? Where's my son? And he just said, oh, I'm so sorry, he said. But all the people were jumping on the coaches to get, which I understand now, I didn't at the time, I was angry. How dare they take my son's seat? But you know, you can understand jumping on the coaches to get home to their families. And I said, you've left my son up there. I hope he's got money on him to get home. So my husband said, I'll go back up to Sheffield. You go home, Mark, and if he comes home in the meantime, you can let me know and I'll turn around and come home. I said, well, please phone me up every half hour, Jimmy, to let me know if you found him. Please phone me every half hour and I can tell you whether he's home or not. My husband, off he went. I go home, 3 younger children. I had them in bed. Obviously, can you imagine the devastation of them? They were still getting in and out the bed, crying. Mum, what's up? Where's our James? What's up? Go back to bed. He'll be home shortly. Go back to bed. Put them back to bed because they were, at the time, they were only 6, 7, and 9. And I had another son who was 15, going on 16. I said, just go back to bed. Your brother will be home soon. Go back to bed. Phone goes, my husband. Mark, have you heard anything? No. Another half hour. Heard anything? No. Time goes on. The last phone call I got from my husband was around about 3 in the morning. By then, I was more than upset. I was panicking. I was devastated. And I think I upset the children because they heard me crying. And the younger ones came out and said, Mum, what's the matter? Where is he home? And I remember shouting at the younger ones and saying, just get back into bed. I've got enough to do. Get back into bed. Anyway, the last phone call I got, as I said, from my husband, around about 3:30. And 4 o'clock. 4:30. 5 o'clock, heard nothing. And round about 5:30, I decided, oh God, I need to do something. I've got to do something. He could be walking around devastated, what he saw. I go out to the front to get a bit of fresh air. And as I walked out to the front, I saw my sister standing at the top of the road, my other sister. And I just looked at her and I just, what's Joan doing there? What is she standing there for? This is going through my head. And I thought, what has she heard that I've not heard? And then she started to walk towards me. And as she started to walk towards me, it must have been just going on 6 o'clock, and my husband, my brother-in-law, my other son, came round the corner in the car. My husband wasn't driving. My brother-in-law was. And I saw my husband's head in his hands. But all I was looking for was my son in the car. I was just looking for James. And I couldn't see him. And I thought, oh God, no. Why isn't James there? And the car pulled up. And as I pulled up, I started to walk away. And as I'm walking away, my husband gets out and he just shouted, "Mark." And I knew he was sobbing. And I knew. So what did I do? I run. I started running away. And I just turned around and I just said to him, "Please, please, Jim. Please, I'm begging you, don't catch me up. Because if you don't catch me up, my son's still alive. Please, don't catch me up. Because if you catch me up, you're going to tell me." And I carried on running. And then something made me stop as I got down the road. Turned around and I just saw my husband sitting on the floor. And I just thought, oh, I have to go back to him. I just have to go back. But I hope he's going to tell me James is in hospital. And as I went back to him, he just stood up and he went, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." And I said, "No, Jim. He can't be gone. That was his first away game. I've never allowed him to go to games. Why is he can't be gone. There's nothing, Mark." And he gave me this bag, this clear bag. And what was in the bag? It was James's chain from around his neck, his belt from around his pants, his watch, and the stub of his ticket of where he went through the turnstiles. And I just said to him, "I don't want that. I don't want them. I want my son. Please, give me my son." "Sorry, Mark." So from that day on, we had one hell of a fight on our hands. Because the first thing you want to know, why? Why did he die? He only went to a football match. He went by coach. I found out he was in the ground at 1:15. Kick-off wasn't till 3 o'clock. He couldn't have been any earlier. So why is he dead? Why? And as obviously the devastation, you go up and you have to go and see your son. The first thing I wanted to do was go and collect my son to bring him home. So my husband had to come back up to Sheffield with me the same, the following day. And we went up to Sheffield. And all I wanted to do was to bring James home to his family. No matter what, I just wanted to bring him home. We goes up and we get sent to what they call the medical legal centre. We go there. And when I walked in this room, it just felt dark. And I could hear all this sobbing and this crying and screaming. And I walked in as silly as I was, thinking, all these people didn't know James. Why are they all crying? All these people didn't know my son. What are they all doing here? Didn't take into my head. These are poor people who had lost their loved ones as well. But all you could think of is your own. Anyway, you give your name in, and you give who you've come to see. And you're sitting there, and you're amongst all these people that didn't know who they were, all these people, men, women, and obviously some younger ones, the siblings of them. And all of a sudden your name gets called, Margaret Aspinall. Yes. And you're crying. Are you ready? I said, ready? Ready for what? What am I ready for? No, I just want to take my son home, give me my son. And they said, well, we want you to come into this room then. Take her into this room. And it was a dark room. And there was a curtain across. And they, are you ready? I'm ready ready to take my son, yes. I'm ready to take my son home, yes. Just give me my son. So they opened the curtain and there's your son. And it was a glass screen. And all I wanted to do was go in and hug him and give him a love and give him a squeeze and tell him, your mum's here. Your mum's here. And I said, I need to go into him. Can I hug him? I need to hug him. I need to let him know his mum and dad's here. Sorry, Mrs. Aspinall, he doesn't belong to you now. He belongs to the coroner. What? He belongs to the coroner? I said, no. He's never belonged to any coroner. He's mine. He's my child. I want to take him home. He needs to be with his family. Sorry, Mrs. Aspinall. No, you can't go in. You can't touch him. That's all a mother ever wants to do, is to hug a child, to love a child. Anyway, to cut all that part of it out, within a matter of 4 days, headlines of a paper, the dead caused their own death, really. The real truth. Fans urinated on the dead. Fans robbed the dead. Fans were drunk. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this is the story they're going to say about our fans. Because what we saw, what I saw on the TV, our fans done everything they possibly could to help them people who were brought on the pitch. I didn't see anybody else helping. Just, yes, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying some policemen didn't do something. But there's a lot who done nothing, who froze and done nothing. And without our fans of that day, a lot more could have died and would have died. Then I remember, 4 weeks after the disaster, we got taken to the Anglican Cathedral for a memorial service. And we were put at the back, all the families were at the back and all the front seats were all empty. And I thought, what are they for? Why are we here? Why are we put at the back? Even then you start thinking, what's going on here? Mrs. Thatcher, and don't like to talk ill of the dead, but I'm going to tell you a story. Mrs. Thatcher come along and all her entourage, all of them, and they all get put in the front seats while the families of the 96, well, 95 at that time, were put at the back. But you're devastated, you think, I shouldn't be here. What am I doing at this service? What am I doing with these people, these government people? What am I doing here? And I remember, after the service, somebody came up to all the families and asked us to go down into the crypt that Mrs. Thatcher wanted to meet us. And I said to my husband, I'm not going. Don't want to see the woman. I just don't want to see her. And whether, I don't know what part political party you're all believing, it doesn't matter. But I do remember the miners. And that always played on my mind. My mother always taught me properly about that. That all grieve. And I thought, I don't want to see that woman. Don't want to see her. But I got encouraged to go down to the crypt with the rest of the families, and that's what I did. And it was regimented. We were all lined up, all put in a, like a line, and Mrs. Thatcher would come along and shake their hands. And when she got to me, She put her hand out and I said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Thatcher, I can't shake your hand. Why ever not? I will shake your hand if I get the truth of why my son is in a grave not far from here. First away again. I will shake your hand if you give me the truth. I said, because a certain headline of a certain paper, I said, all them lies about our fans and our dead. Give me the truth of why that happened, then I'll shake your hand. And she said, oh, you are so angry, my dear. You are so angry. I said, I'm more than angry, Mrs. Thatcher. I said, I'm trying to be respectful here, I said, but I'm devastated. Absolutely devastated, as you were when your son went missing. And you sent the army looking for your son. My son didn't go missing. My son was at a football game. My son should have been protected. And he's in a grave over the road at 18 years of age. Life taken away alongside another 94 at that time. You give me the truth of that, and she said, oh, there were 750 policemen on duty on that day. I said, well, you got that wrong, Mrs. Thatcher. That's where my strength started to come to me, because I knew there was going to be a massive cover-up. A massive cover-up. I said, there was more than 750, Mrs. Thatcher. I said, so you're getting your facts wrong while you're speaking to me in front of all these families. I said, get your facts right. I said, you tell me what were they doing. And will all of you believe me when I turn around and say to you, her words to me were, their job, my dear, their job. I said, their job? 95 people are in the grave. Is that their job? And she said, I better step away, dear, from you, she said, because you are more than angry. And I said, no, Mrs. Thatcher, can I do you a favour? I'm stepping away from you. And I'm getting out of here right now. And I walked out. And I looked at all the other poor families and I thought, God love them, they're that devastated. They were that much in grief. It was only 4 weeks after that they went along with the system. So my message to you is from that day on, it made me strong. I didn't go weaker. My strength was to get to the truth. What happened to them, 96? Who gave the lies? Who was the safety officer who had the job for safety? And that took the families, and I'm so proud of them to this day. We are still on a journey. It gave us the strength to fight, because if you're not true to yourself, you can't be true to others. So always be true to yourself and never, ever give up. It took us 30 years. We've been through an inquiry. We've had judicial reviews. We've had a private prosecution. We've gone through every channel, the Taylor Report, scrutiny, still an accidental death. And them verdicts will never be changed. It's never been done and it's not going to be changed. 96 accidental deaths at a football ground. Not possible. Absolutely not possible. So we stuck together as a families. We got together. We got together as a group. The families have done a tremendous job by staying together. But the most difficult thing for us was trying to change them verdicts. 96 accidental deaths. It'll never be done. We had top people who said, Margaret, there's no chance. No, we felt everywhere we went, with the government, with everything, with the establishment, with the media, how are we going to change their opinions? How are we going to do it? And how we done it? By staying together. By sticking together. And the support we've had, a lot of them from our survivors to this day, who are still suffering the traumatic effects, have been so good. Our city has been fantastic. So what we've done, I've met a few prime ministers now. I've met quite a few Home Secretaries. And we've listened to the government and gone along with their way of thinking. We've done everything by the board. Doesn't work. Believe you me, it doesn't work. What you have to keep doing is hammering on doors like we did and saying, you know, we're not going away. You're giving us that scrutiny. That scrutiny was appalling. But we went along with it because we couldn't do anything else. But we're not happy and we're not going away. And what happened on it was, after all of them years, it was on the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough, and families have never trusted any MPs, none of them. Either Labour, Conservative, I'm going through all of them, none of them. They all made the fancy promises and not one of them fulfilled it. Until the 20th anniversary, as the chairman of the group at that time, I made a decision which I should never have done, but I did. I should have consulted the committee, because we have a committee. I didn't. I knew we're getting nowhere. We've got to change things. We've done everything by the board. We've got to change things. And Andy Burnham, do you all know who Andy Burnham is? He's the Metro Mayor of Manchester. Andy Burnham got in touch with me and said, Margaret, I've got a letter from Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, to read out to the family, for you to read out to the families on the anniversary, on the 20th anniversary. I said, I'm not reading it. I'm not reading it, Andy. You read it. And he said, oh, Mark, he said, I said, no, you read it. I'm asking you to stand up in front of everybody and you read it from Gordon Brown and give the man his due. He was terrified. I said, you'll get some stick, Andy. I know you will. But you just have to take it. Just take it. And on the 20th anniversary, Andy gets up. And there was 30-odd thousand people at the service at Anfield. 32,000 people. And when Andy gets up and turned round and said, I've got a message to read out on behalf of the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. And just before he started it, somebody shouted out, justice. And the whole stadia started chanting justice to Andy Burnham. The whole stadia. And he took it. He stood there. I've got to admire him. And he took it. And the same evening, we were going down to get the freedom of the city, the families. After the service, we were getting taken down for them. And Andy come along, and he got hold of my hand, and he said, I promise you, Margaret, I'll take this message back. I said, Andy, you've got to. I said, because if this goes pear-shaped, the families are going to go mad. Because I took a chance by asking you to stand there because they don't trust anybody. I don't trust anybody. I don't trust the MPs. Don't let me down. Please don't let me down. And you know, he didn't. Within weeks, me and the executive committee were going meeting with the Ministry of Justice. And that's when our fight began. We told them, no. We've listened to you. We've done it by your way. We've done it your way. Now, this is what needs doing, what we say should be done. And within a matter of months, the HIP was set up, which is the Hillsborough Independent Panel. And that took maybe 2 years. But we got the freedom of information, what we've been fighting for. We got full disclosure, what was never allowed to happen before. We got all of that. And at the end of them, a couple of years, when the Bishop James Jones, who was the chair of the independent panel. We all met at the Anglican Cathedral. And the first thing he said was, I know what you all want to hear. Have we found any new evidence? Yes, we have. That new evidence went forward. From there, we had a new inquest on all of the 96. That was a 2-year job. 2 years it took. And we found Duckenfield guilty. They were unlawfully killed. We changed all of them verdicts. And to me, that's a big achievement, not just for the 96, but for the good of this nation. Because it shows you persistence, dedication, commitment, love. It pays off if you never, ever give up. And the thing from this now is Duckenfield. He was the chief commander of the day. He's at a new trial in October because the jury at the last one couldn't reach a verdict on him. We think it was 9-3 for us and 3 for him. So we had to wait only about 3 weeks ago to see if we're having a retrial. And that's why I cannot go on social media now, because it'll be contempt of court. So the retrial is the 7th of October, and we've got another 6 people coming up for a trial next year for the cover-up. So it's been 30-odd years. Many a time you just want to give up and you think, I can't take any more, can't do any more. But I believe you me. If it took us 60 years to get to the truth, which we've had, I'd wait as long as we get to the truth. Because I remember, before I go, I remember all I was asking for in the very early days was, is there any video coverage of James? Could you tell me who had the honour, and I will say honour, of helping my son when he took his last breath? Because I was angry. I was there when he took his first breath. And when he most needed me, I wasn't. So I wanted to know who helped my son when he went out of this world, who was with him. I think every parent needs to know that. And they kept telling me, we've no video coverage, none at all of James. And we don't know who helped James. We know somebody did, but we don't know who. Only 2016, at the inquest, I heard and saw loads of coverage of James when he was in the pen, how early he was, when he was on the pitch, when nobody helped him, when a policeman just stepped over him, looked down and threw his coat, took his thing off and just threw it over his face. That's what I saw in 2016. Then they had a pathologist up to give evidence on James. And that's when I found out James could have been saved with early intervention. So James was probably left on that pitch on his back, when he could have been saved. So that to me was well worth the fight to get to the truth. And I say to all of you, the only message I can leave all of you is, no matter what you fight for, or what you believe in, or what you want to do in life, like this lovely lady here, no matter what you want to do in life, you can achieve it. Ours, we can't bring back the 96, but all we're doing now and what we want more than anything is a level playing field for ordinary people. If the police get paid to go against us, then the ordinary people should have the same amount of money to help them to fight any injustice. Never give up. Always have hope. That is important, to always have hope. Have dedication. Commitment. Have loyalty. Respect. But most importantly, be true to yourselves and help others. Because what we're doing now, it's no good for us. But hopefully for the future of this country, it's going to help others. And that's the only message I can leave. And thank you everybody for the support that we've had for all of these years, and we still get to this day. Thank you so much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.